think your interaction comes from the oral argument. Again, you are the first case of the last month. 98-3329. Is it there? Viral, thank you. Versus McTaggart. And we have 22 minutes for David Sparrow, representing the McTaggart. 3 minutes for Mr. Haas, representing the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, and Cannabis. 3 minutes for Mr. Brennan, 5 minutes for rebuttal for Mr. Sparrow. Is that correct? Okay. Sparrow, can I ask you? Okay.
Well, good morning, Your Honor. I'm David Sparrow, the attorney for the McTaggarts in this matter. And let me just check the time. Well, this case, as I assume you know from having read the briefs, is a case that involves whether or not the administrative code of the Department of Consumer Protection, 134, whether it will have life and vitality, whether it will be helping tenants in the state of Wisconsin, or whether it's just going to be a number of words on a page and not really effective. Not really a benefit to tenants throughout our state. That's what this case is about. There's a lot of little parts here and there, but that is the main thrust of this whole case. Now, leases were not always contracts, and back in the prior turn of the century, when the 1800s returned to the 1900s, the idea of a tenant getting property from a landlord was very much the same as a transfer of real property. All the property rules applied to it, and landlords and tenants had free rein to contract however they wished. There was basically no particular regulation of it at all. However, in Wisconsin, starting in around 1926, with the Hannon versus Harper case, that was the first case here where this court did impose upon the leasing activities between these parties, they imposed certain conditions. In the Hannon versus Harper case, it was the implied covenant of quiet enjoyment.
Counsel, are you debating tonight? The question here is severability. We look at this rather lengthy contract as a standard contract and then an addendum A, addendum B. Are you disputing that it can't be severed, or is this just a public policy argument that if we allow this, we're going to allow, we'll allow such things as you have a contract that 99 clauses are void and one is okay, so we'll sever all of them. But it's just because from an equitable standpoint, it seems to me that your client really benefits from this. They broke the lease, and then they're asking for double damages. Is that the public policy in this case?
I believe that it's very much a requirement that this clause not be severed, and that none of the clauses within 134.07 or 0.08, which is the listed of prohibited lease provisions, if a lease has any of those clauses in it, it would not be severable, would be my position. And that would be, I guess there's a number of different ways to analyze that or think about it. One would be that simply by the fact that the department has evaluated this situation, the question of what clauses are so important that they need to be prohibited, that alone, I believe, should lead the court to say that as a matter of law, those clauses cannot be severed.
Do you your position is that this is a totally void lease. Is that your
totally
position?
Totally void lease.
Totally
yes.
void. Therefore, your clients, the Taggarts, don't owe anything to the landlord.
Well, they do owe something. And
they owe.
They would owe, in a sense, all the cases that evaluate the issue of voiding of a contract have all said that when that's done, it is most appropriate to have a quantum merit entitlement on the part of the other party, in this case, the landlord. And that would be what the McTaggarts should owe, and that is the type of ruling that the trial court made. It was like a month-to-month tenancy. They did have to pay the rent for all the time they occupied. They did have to give a month's notice, and if they moved out before the end of that month, still pay the rent, if okay. they did do that.
But that's month-to-month for quantum merit. And the reason for that is because if it's void, 704.01 provides that the valid lease is for a periodic tenant.
Exactly.
Okay. So quantum merit can't be here the amount of money that they that the landlord expended to re-rent this premise.
Correct.
It has to be any monthly payments they owe for occupying the premises and for any month that they did not give valid notice that they were leaving.
Correct, and also it would be any damages or cleaning for which they're responsible beyond normal wear and tear, which some were found and they paid that. There's no dispute about that.
So what do they want? They want the $1,790 back, less cleaning costs?
No, the trial judge did the mathematical analysis in the manner provided by Norwick, which was the correct way to do it, which would be to look at the deposit to determine the amount of deductions that were appropriate, which he did, subtract that from the deposit, and then you see what's left, and that's the amount. It should have been returned. That's the amount that gets doubled.
All right. So we're going to question counsel for the landlord to see, assuming it's a void lease, whether that amount, is that amount in dispute?
I don't believe that amount is in dispute at all.
So what's really in dispute is whether this is a void lease or a valid lease, as Justice Wilcox said.
Correct, and you know, whichever way that goes, how the mathematical determination will be made for the damages is not in dispute at all.
What ramifications does your position have to other Department of Ag rulings, orders? I think of, if I'm correct, 125 Ag. Doesn't that deal with the mobile home? I have to
use mobile home, right.
Mobile homes. And for years there were, I think it's safe to say, some outrageous conduct by mobile home operators, and ergo 125 came into effect. There are specific restrictions in Ag 125 that limit what cannot be in the lease agreement, if I remember correctly. What implication does your argument have for those kinds of restrictions of leases in other areas that are the subject of administrative rules by the Department of Ag?
Well, I guess I believe that my position is not something new at all. My position is that the rulings in Permastone and Huff and Morse already state the law, and what I'm here today saying is that I'm seeking to have the court here overturn the Court of Appeals when they erroneously tried to change that law. It already was the law for half a century now that if there's a lease, a contract entered into in a manner specifically prohibited by, at that time it was the Ag rules, now it's the ATCP rules, then that contract is void. So in the context of the 125 for the mobile home, if a lease agreement was written up, which included a clause specifically prohibited, my position would be that that means that whole lease is void. Just as in Permastone, which was a home repair case, the contract there was void. Huff and Morris was auto repair. And
it doesn't seem, you know, the Court of Appeals said, gee, it's awfully harsh to say that you're gonna dump this, what is it, 2, 3, 4 page single space lease just because one of the provisions is invalid. I mean, everybody agrees the provision is invalid. There's no dispute about that, right?
Correct. I believe that's correct.
So why can't you just sever it? It's not the essence of the contract. The essence of this contract is you're going to take it for a year. Your clients can take it for a year. You're going to owe X amount of rent per month. You're going to forfeit part or all of the deposit if you don't leave the premises in the condition called for, right? That's the essence of the contract.
Well, I guess that's maybe part of the question is what exactly is the essence? Certainly everything you stated would be part of the essence, but there's two ways to look at it. One would be that the court will say that in every case from now on that comes before the court, we're going to have a complete evaluation factually with testimony and all of what is the essence of the contract in this case. Did the landlord in this case say, I want that illegal, I mean, they wouldn't say I want that illegal clause, but I want that clause in my lease or I won't rent to you. Sure, it's for 1 year, but also I want the right to say that I'm absolved of the duty to provide a habitable premises. It's another one of the prohibited provisions. And how are we, if we don't have a bright line rule here saying that the department has determined these clauses are prohibited. If you put them in there, your whole lease is void. Everybody can follow that. That's an easy one to follow. Everybody knows how to apply it. But the alternative would be to evaluate every single lease separately, to have testimony about what was the nature of the negotiation. And the tenant's going to have to be able to develop that evidence and know ahead of time what clauses are illegal or not, and try to negotiate with the landlord and somehow maintain the evidence that they can present in court in a manner that's admissible evidence to be able to prove that the landlord said, I insist on having that in there.
Now, your real issue, as I read the briefs, was look, if you don't penalize the landlord, then you let the landlord put in all these clauses that in effect, quote, terrorize the tenant. The tenant thinks they're valid and then acts on it when they're not valid. That's the essence of your argument, isn't it?
Correct. That having them in there creates that concern, and that was a point made by the department in its report that it made to the legislature when they were proposing the rule in the first place was just what you said.
But this lease says it's all subject to Chapter 134 of the code, doesn't it? And the laws of the state. The words to that effect.
Right.
So why shouldn't we just say, well, the tenant ought to get a copy of the code and look at the law, and tenant will figure out that this is this clause about paying attorney fees, that's the clause we're talking about, paying attorney fees is invalid, and they can just, they were not going to have to pay the attorney fees, the heck with it. Therefore, they should be held, I mean, everybody is held to understand the law, right? Fiction, but
right, that's what
we're held to
lawyers say.
So why don't we just say that?
Well, I guess then it's a question of will that be effective in accomplishing the goal of the department and by implication, the legislature, since they allowed this rule to be adopted, would that accomplish the goal? Because in, you know, evaluating legislative intent, you know, like one of the cardinal, this is out of Shands versus Castrovinci, the cardinal rule in interpreting statutes is to favor a construction which will fulfill the purpose of the statute over a construction which defeats the manifest object of the act. I believe that we could all agree that the intent of the department was that there would be no such leases with clauses as, you know, any of those seven prohibited types.
The regulations don't say that, though.
Regulations
don't say that the lease is void if it has this.
Regulation does not say that, correct. That's comes out of the case law, Permastone versus Merkel, specifically says that it's void if it's adopted in violation of the, in that case it was a different ATCP code. And Huff and Morris also says the exact same thing. And in Huff and Morris, which was a case that was decided just a couple years after this 134 rule was adopted, the Attorney General appeared on behalf of the state and specifically argued that it was a matter of law that having a contract that was written in a manner contrary or adopted in a manner contrary to the regulation was void as a matter of law. That was the state's position in that case, and that was adopted by the court in Huff and Morris. And the idea of the contract being void is a matter of the various cases that have been decided over the years by this court and appellate courts in our state.
Could I ask you a hypothetical question here? Suppose the lease did not have the offensive clause. The parties looked at the lease, discussed the lease, and just before McTaggart's were going to sign, Supreme Builder said, almost like giving a Miranda warning, "Pal, we are an outstanding facility here, but we enforce this lease. You require us to go into court to enforce the provisions of this lease, we are going to get reasonable attorney's fees." What's the result there?
So that would be an oral statement, not in the lease. And then I guess there'd be a question of whether they specifically said, "All right, we agree that you have that right."
Say they don't say anything.
They don't say anything.
I mean, let's say the motive was to terrorize the potential tenant.
Probably it would have been. I guess I think in that case, there'd be a serious question of whether that clause, so to speak, was that really part of the contract at all, or because it was oral, because it wasn't in there, because it was simply stated separately from the actual contract. I think in that case it would be debatable whether it really was part of the contract at all or it was just a statement the landlord was making.
Now, a rental agreement doesn't have to be in writing if it's less than a year or less.
Correct, but in his scenario, there was a written rental agreement that was being entered into, but then there was a oral statement.
Have a parole evidence rule.
Correct.
Potential.
Okay,
but suppose it's all
oral. Right, I guess if it's all oral, then it's as much part of the contract as any other part, such as the rent is $500 a month.
Well, if you're right that this is a void lease, then what would stop the landlord here from, after 5 months, landlord gets somebody who really wants this place and will double the rent. So the landlord calls the tenant and says, "You know, too bad, void lease. I goofed, void lease. The court says lease is gone. you're now month-to-month tenant, and I'm giving you notice now that you're to be out of here in a month.
Right. Well, that is somewhat the example of, I can't remember the name of the case, but it's the one from New York that Mr. Byron, getting his name right, Mr. Byron's attorney brought up. And in that case, the court there said, but the rule is made to protect the tenant, in this case the consumer, and so that person for whom the protection is written has the right to take advantage of that protection. The person who violated the rule can't use their own violation for their own benefit, and in that case they refused to do that.
So it's a one-way street?
Because the Consumer Protection Code is protecting consumers. Just like the, in this case, the attorney's fee provision of 100.20 sub 5 is entirely for the consumers. The other side doesn't have a similar provision in the law. That has been the finding of the department and the legislature that this class of citizens needs extra protection. And the whole private attorney general issue is very important, because whatever the ruling is that we have to, from this case, when you write it, definitely needs to be one that will encourage everyday citizens who are renters to take up the action and the job of our whole state and serve as private attorneys general.
Mr. Sperr, the restatement of contracts has a general rule in regard to severance. In other words, if we applied the restatement, it's my understanding that we would sever this provision. Why shouldn't we do that here? What is it that causes us to say we're not going to follow the restatement in this case?
The thing that would make it different is that in this case, we have a violation of a penal statute, which is different than just a straight contract. It's also a consumer protection statute, so special attention needs to be given to making sure that the protection actually is there for the consumers. And also there's the fact that there is some benefit to, in this case, the landlord. The quantum merit idea is present. In one of the cases, the consumer tried to purchase a car, there was an issue about a violation, and then they tried to be able to pay absolutely zero and yet keep the car. And of course the court said, you can't do that, that's going too far.
One of the things that bothers me is the way the penalty statute is, I shouldn't say penalty, but five, sub five, any person suffering pecuniary loss because of a violation by any other person of any order issued under this section may sue for damage. Is that what the section we're under?
That's the section, yes.
Okay. In any court of competent jurisdiction, recover twice the amount of pecuniary loss. What's the pecuniary loss here?
In this case, it's the amount of the security deposit that should have been returned because it was just a month-to-month tenancy.
Oh, and what's the violation of any order issued under this subsection?
Well, the order is ATCP 134, and of course there was the violation of having the provision in the lease that was specifically prohibited, and also the violation of not returning part of the deposit that was due.
And that caused the damage because the landlord thought it was a valid lease and he thought it was invalid.
Correct. And he had a very large security deposit, twice a month's rent, which is pretty big, permissible, not in the city of Madison, but it was there. And that's why there ended up being something like this. And it's very analogous to the Armour versus Klecker ruling, in the sense that in that case there was a determination that the lease was void for an entirely different reason. But then just because of that judicial determination, the security deposit deduction, which otherwise would have been okay, was not okay.
Counsel, you have 5 minutes in the rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Comfortable, you may lower that lectern. There's a button on. Yeah. That's it. We're a high tech court.
I was looking for a little box like right. Donna Shalala used to have to use. Good morning. My name is Teal Haas. I'm an attorney with the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, and I'm here this morning to speak on behalf of the department as an amicus in this case. The case is important to the department. We felt it important to file an amicus in this matter because this case does go beyond the landlord-tenant issue before the court. It affects all of the department's consumer protection rules that have been promulgated under the department's authority under 100.20 of the statutes for the department to create rules that will protect consumers from unfair trade practices and unfair methods of competition. The legislature gave us that very broad power. The legislature also included within that power the remedy available to consumers who have been harmed under subsection 5 of that statute to bring actions and to recoup double damages and attorney's fees and costs.
Nobody's been harmed here, though, right?
No, that's not true. The consumers have been harmed. The landlord is also coming to you with dirty, unclean hands in this case. These rules have been on the books for 21 years, since 1980. This clause is specifically prohibited. It is found to be an unfair trade practice. But
there's no actual harm here. Nobody's arguing any actual harm. There's maybe some systemic or metaphysical sort of a harm, but there's no actual harm to these tenants. And this, in fact, is a case where the tenants are seeking to use the Consumer Protection Code not as a shield against unfair trade practices by an unscrupulous landlord, but as a sword to excuse their own material breach of the contract.
Your Honor, I don't believe so. I believe that in any landlord-tenant case, you usually have both parties somewhat at fault. Previous decisions of this court have also found that where the tenants have violated some part of the rules, the landlord has violated the administrative code. The contract itself becomes invalidated, and then you look to the quantum merit and of the situation. But the underlying public policy is what we have to keep going after. The tenants in this case did have to come and defend this action. They had to incur attorney's fees and costs. And they had a bright attorney who found this illegal clause that they hadn't seen. And that makes a difference.
But if they hadn't seen, if there's a concession that they didn't see the illegal clause, then there can be no claim that it had any sort of terror effect on them in the negotiation of this contract. So there really is no harm to anybody by declaring this clause non-essential and severable and enforcing the contract.
The department disagrees that if without the remedy available to consumers to sever these illegal provisions, to void the contract, and to then to encourage tenants to bring actions to defend their own individual rights, to in that role also serve as private attorneys general and defend the public's rights, and to serve as a supplement to the department's ability to enforce these kinds of rules, there would be no meaning to having a prohibition in our rules that says this is a prohibited and it's a violation of our rules.
Well, there is meaning to the extent that if any landlord attempts to enforce a clause like this, they're precluded from doing so.
Which is exactly what the trial court did in this situation.
Well, right, but what's wrong with the rule that says this is an unenforceable contract clause and you can't recover under it, but the rest of the contract is okay?
What other parts of the lease, this, as one of the justices noticed, this is an extensively long lease, lots and lots of clauses. What other parts are severable? What does the tenant know at the time they sign that lease? Which parts does the landlord not intend to enforce? Which parts are not essential to the contract?
What's the effect of the the clause in the contract in the department's view that pertains to controlling law, which essentially indicates that all parties to the lease recognize that their rights and obligations under the lease are subject to Chapter 704 and Chapter 134 of the Code.
I believe it means that the landlord who wrote the lease, who presented it, and under general contract principles is certainly bound by that, he knew what the provisions were. He should have known what the provisions were under ATCP 134 and the consequences for violating those provisions. Those consequences have been in place with the Supreme Court decisions since Permastone and clearly since Chance versus Castrovinci, and that is what we would ask the court to uphold.
But in those cases, we were talking about essential contract clauses, not non-essential ones, weren't we?
I do not believe the decisions in any of those cases identified that or made that distinction of essential clauses versus non-essential clauses.
But as a factual matter, that was the case. I mean, you were talking about contract clauses in those leases that went, or agreements that went to the heart of the contract, as opposed to here, we're talking about recoverability of attorney's fees, which is a non-essential clause.
I don't believe that's the case, because when we look at the analysis in those cases, what the courts focused on was the underlying public policy of protecting all consumers. And sometimes consumers may not have performed perfectly, but there are, the landlord doesn't go away with no remedies. The landlord does get the remedies to which he is entitled under the law, but he also cannot ask this court and ask the state to help him enforce an invalid contract that he knew or should have known was invalid at the time he had the tenancy.
Could I follow up Justice Sykes' question? This provision on controlling law in the basic lease, you say that gives the landlord notice of these particular provisions in your rules. What about any statute or any other administrative rules under any other statute? Is the lease void because of any other provisions other than the ones in that section?
Other leases happen for violations of security deposit requirements and other things. The underlying public policy is that the distinction between this lease and any other kind of contract is that it's a consumer lease. It's a consumer protection case. It is specifically between a consumer and a landlord. There is not equal bargaining power between those two parties. Never has been, never will be. And the department and the legislature have agreed that special protections are needed in these circumstances. So any violation of the administrative rules that are created for consumers can lead to that remedy under 100.20 sub 5.
Isn't that a rather harsh rule? What you're saying is that the landlord, whoever drafts this, is held to know what the law is, and if there's any violation, then it becomes void.
Yes, that is correct. The landlord should be held to know what the law is. He's the one drafting the contract. And is this result harsh? Possibly, that's what other courts have said, including Armour versus Klecker. But it also said, but it is consistent with the underlying public policy behind these administrative rules, behind the provisions of Section 100.20.
Thank you, Attorney House. Attorney Friend, representing the landlord.
Attorney Thomas Friend, Petrie and Stocking, appearing for the landlord in this case. And I guess my first point is we're trying to change the law here.
Before you get to your first point, you agree that the clause is invalid under the administrative
yes, order? It was a mistake to put it in there.
Okay. You agree that what the trial court did, assuming it's invalid and assuming the trial court is correct, you agree the quantum merit is the deposit less the deductions?
Well, I don't agree that quantum merit goes with the court's decision, because quantum merit, in my mind, would say you agreed to lease this place for a year, even though the lease is invalid, you still are responsible for the rent for one year.
What about 704.01 says that if there's no valid lease, then you're a periodic payment tenant for the method of payment?
Then you're going away from Quantum America and going back to that 704 statute.
But then there is a statute that particularly covers when there's an invalid lease.
Right, and that's the statute that applies. But Quantum America would be, you get the value of what you were promised, what you promised to give. In this case, the tenant promised to lease the premises for a year. He broke the promise. Equity would say that he lives up to his bargain of having the facility for a year. The landlord did what he was supposed to, try to re-rent it. There's also a comment made about the double security deposit. The double security deposit was because this tenant had a pet, and so there was a special pet security deposit. The normal security deposit would have been the normal 1 month's rent.
Let me just ask you this then. If you should, if the court should hold that this is a void lease, does the court then have to decide what your damages are to Quantum Merit? Does it go back? What happens?
Well, I think what Judge Kahn did was a reasonable approach if you do a quantum, if you hold the leases void. He went back to the statute, said this is a month-to-month lease, and gave a 60-day notice. This is what we're going to do.
So if it's a void lease, that ends the case. You're not asking.
I'm not asking to go back.
Okay, we got that out of the way. Sorry to have bothered you. You may proceed.
Well, and then I go here. We've had this great legislative argument here. If this was a legislature committee, the Joint Finance Committee, which several of you have sat on, for example, this was a great argument saying the law should be changed. They cite the law changes in 1978, abuses of tenants. That's true. I'm not going to argue, but we've had this rule since 1978. In 1998, December, the department changed Chapter 134, made a whole bunch of changes to this. Where was this change? If this is such an important rule, why didn't you add to the section of 134.08 any lease that contains any of this clause is void and shall become a month-to-month lease or some other rule? Why?
Well, but counsel, you've got a silent law. It doesn't say it one way or another. This court is obligated, apparently, to interpret which way it's going to go.
Right. Yes.
And if it says that it's not void, it's interpreted the law.
Right.
If it says it is void, it's interpreted the law. So we got to go one way or another. Why should we go the way you suggest?
Well, because common law in this state, and is confirmed by restatement CJS, by the cases we cited in our brief, says that if you have one non-essential illegal clause, it's severed from the rest of the contract. And that's the principle that we have in the state applying to all contracts.
Counsel?
Yes?
Sorry to interrupt, but so you're saying if we have one non-essential, so are you saying if, as I gave the example to opposing counsel, you have 100 clauses and 90 of them are non-essential, but if they're invalid, they're not legal, that also should be severed in that manner? In other words, this has one clause in a rather lengthy lease. What about if there are 50 clauses in this very same lease, but then you concede that it should be void? Do we care about the number?
No, I don't think you care about the number.
Well, then if you don't care about the number, then would that example be illustrating that you could have one essential clause and 99 non-essential clauses, but we would still sever?
Yes.
Does that make sense?
It does, if you could come up with a factual situation that where you would have 99 illegal clauses and one legal essential clause. And I can't conceive of a thing.
Wouldn't the policy be then, I mean, if you're in the landlord in and let's say neither are met with first law, but get a standard lease. This started with a standard lease.
Yes.
And then there were several addendums.
Yes.
As I look at it. And in one of those addendums, the first A in the middle is where this last part of the paragraph would be voidable section. I find there's some sympathy that we can't expect, and I don't know if everyone should be held to that nothing is severable and we're always going to enforce it. I don't know if that's a good rule, but certainly a rule that says that when you have the greater majority of a contract, which would be illegal, void in the sense of the Department of Agriculture administrative rule, you're still saying that that should be severed and we should just get back to whatever the essential.
Well, it's, yes, you have to look at the essential. In this case, they lease the premises for a year. If the premises had been truly uninhabitable, like one of the cases they're cited by the tenants in this case, where I think it was the Armour case, where they brought in a doctor saying it was uninhabitable. Yes, that was a key provision of that lease. What are the key elements? I can't give you a practical example where you're going to have 99 provisions that are illegal and one provision that are legal.
I probably can't either, but I thought I did.
But it is taking the principle. But and you look at the cases that are cited by the tenant in this case, and in each case, the element is essential element. Permastone, the consideration was a judgment note, something that's been illegal for years. This was probably one of the first cases in Wisconsin that declared it illegal on a number of grounds, not only the ATCP regulations, but on constitutional grounds. That's the consideration of that, and that's why the court found it illegal, and I have to agree with that.
Counsel?
Yes.
Let's assume that you win this case, and this court says that this can be severed. And I'm a landlord, and I'm drafting a new lease next year. What encouragement is there for me to not put in this kind of a clause? It seems to me that my motivation is to put this in because the court has said if you get caught, your only penalty is severance.
Well, if you get caught, you're going to get caught because then you're saying the court commissioners...
But then what happens to me if I get caught?
If you are not trying to enforce it, nothing happens because that's the way it's set forth. The courts, if you take a clause like this into the small claims court in Milwaukee County, they will say, out.
What if the tenant says, look, this place was really bad. Babbage, you rented me a real bad place, and under normal conditions, I would have done thus and such. But I read this lease, and if I don't continue to do this, you could nail me for attorney fees, so I'm not going to enforce my rights.
That is an example that could be a reason for the plaintiff's position, but I think it's a far-fetched position because the lease is also subject to the regulations and the Chapter 704, which is the basic landlord-tenant law, and there is a provision. Now, unfortunately, you know, landlord made a mistake in this case. Whether it was intentional or what is not in this record, I know it's not intentional.
That's what the landlords argued back in 1978 when I was in the legislature, that these things aren't really enforced.
Well, I wouldn't agree. In 1978, they were not enforced. I was practicing landlord-tenant law in Milwaukee County, and you had landlords collecting reasonable attorney's fees in 1978, including clients of mine. So that statement that was quoted, I vehemently disagree with, because they were being enforced.
Well,
in this case, I think it's quite clear from the facts, but for the moment, let's just assume them. This tenant broke a lease. This tenant moved out without justification, had agreed to stay for the year, pay rent for the year, moved out. The tenant comes here, to use an expression that's been used, with unclean hands, and it does not do what Justice Babbage did and say, hey, you know, I really got hurt because I was afraid to enforce my rights because of this clause. You too come, your client comes here with unclean hands. And I'll tell you one of the things that bothers me about this. In the addendum A, number 17 is the clause we're concerned with here. That's the pay expenses, right, including reasonable term. In the same addendum, you got clause 4. Clause 4 says that if the tenant unjustifiably removes from the tenant the landlord from the premises, the landlord can recover in addition to rent other elements of damages and reasonable expenses of listing, advertising, etc., and cites to section 704.29 of the statute. That was a 1993 law. And so whoever drafted this for Supreme Builders obviously was keeping up with the law.
I think so.
That's right. So one would assume that every single one of these addendums was checked against the law. So you got a relatively new statute. When was this signed? 96. Relatively new. Agree with that, perfectly valid. Yet you got an old order. When was the order of the
1978,
and it's still in 17. And this is an addendum attached to the lease, which is form number 19, residential lease. And I see it was drafted by you, the main lease.
The main lease, not the addendum.
That's what I'm getting at.
Okay.
Exactly what I'm getting at. And this form lease, and it's been a long time since I practiced in this area, and I don't remember if this is a form lease that everyone uses and is generally available or not, because there are such residential leases. But this addendum shows, at least to me, that somebody was watching the law, put in the conditions, and rightfully so, this is a landlord drafted lease, put in the conditions that favor the landlord and has every right to do that. It's granted by 704.29 and takes out and does not remove a condition 17.18, which, I mean, the landlord, whoever drafted this, would be assumed to know, even though the tenant does not, that you've got an invalid clause that's been invalid for 78 to 96 is what's 18 years. So I don't know that it matters whether it's intentional or unintentional, but the facts here are not right for either side here. So it seems to me the court has to worry about what's right for the what is the intent of the legislature? What is the intent of the department that deals with this? Because we have more than, what, half the people in Milwaukee and Madison who deal in residential leases, tenants. And I don't know the figures for the rest of the state, but there are some, maybe less than in a metropolitan area. So what is the right law? What is equity for both sides here?
I want to say one thing. 704-29, as written, has been in effect since before 1976 when I started practicing law.
But there's a citation to a 93 law.
Right, but when you cite the law, they evidently looked at the law and said, that's the law. But I'm saying 705-429, they do not believe has been changed for at least 30 years.
But they put it in. That makes my point even longer.
Right.
Somebody's checking the law.
Someone looked and put in the cite to the statute, and someone wrote this. The original counsel in this case actually argued that the landlord did not mean reasonable attorney's fees. The clause that was put in there is what is in commercial leases all the time. It's not forbidden by the statute. The landlord clearly made a mistake. It's not in the principal form lease, which is published by Wisconsin Legal Blank. I'm on there as the drafter, even though the advisory council, the contractual forms advisory council, the Department of Regulation and Licensing, was the principal author, but the secretary decided not to approve a form lease because the landlords and the tenants couldn't agree on what should go in the lease. And then George Russell asked me to be responsible for the drafting of it, and I did. Right. So I am responsible for the first two pages. Right.
And that's not in dispute here. Right. Right. I'm just trying to point out somebody for the landlord did check the statute.
Yes.
If you look carefully, it's a different print set, type set, which means it probably was added after the usual was done. But that isn't the point. The point really here is the bigger point. You've got two parties here. Both of them are before the court having, quote, done wrong. But this court, when it decides on the validity of this lease, governs all landlord-tenant residential leases. So why do you think that landlords should be able, after a decision of this court, to continue putting in this clause? That's what you're asking.
I don't think I'm asking that. I'm asking in this particular fact situation whether one illegal clause invalidates the whole contract. As Judge Bradley raised the points with mobile home parks, for example. Mobile home parks leases are very valuable protections for owners of mobile homes. Chapter 125 puts in a lot of protection for those people, especially the protection of requiring people to move out if they sell their mobile home. If you would invalidate any illegal leases, mobile home owners could be left without leases. There'd be an illegal clause, lease void, you get your rent doubled or tripled, and you can stay or not stay. And so you could have some unintended consequences with landlords. If you throw out the entire lease, are you going to throw out the obligation of the landlord to pay utilities, obligation to make improvements, other things? So there could be some consequences. This, if you're going to have this as a new rule, new penalty, this is the type of thing that should go through the legislature. Yes, in this case, you do have a case where the landlord did wrong. He put in a clause that did not belong in a residential lease. Did he enforce it? No. I know there's some implications in the brief that he did, but the language in the complaint is the standard language that we put in all of our complaints, that the saying attorney's fees and costs mean what we just set forth in 814.
Counsel, I was just looking at your justification with regard to 125 and the unintended consequences. 125 is much tighter than that. It doesn't allow for those kind of unintended consequences.
Right.
So you were just posing a hypothetical. Because in 125, you have a requirement that every lease be in writing, and you have a requirement that it has to be at least a year long, and it's only the tenant that can require something less than that, and that has to be a request in writing, so those greater formals doesn't exist.
Right. I don't pretend to be familiar with 125. I haven't looked at it, but I was trying to respond to your comment earlier.
Let me tell you what my concern is. And my concern is the violation here, of course, is not the enforcement. The violation is that it appears in a lease. And so, let's say I find somewhat persuasive the argument that, look, there's a chilling effect on tenants when this kind of a provision appears in the lease, such that it is an unfair trade practice because people might not exercise their rights. It is deemed an unfair trade practice to have this provision in a lease, and one of the underlying motivations for that denomination is that it chills people from exercising their rights. My daughter saw this in a lease as a student at the university, and she said, they seem like they're doing something bad here, but if I try to take them to court, I could be liable for their attorney's fees. No way. That's a pretty reasonable response. So, aren't you asking that there be no consequence to an unfair trade practice?
No.
What you're asking here.
I don't think
enforcement is irrelevant.
Okay.
As to the violation.
But we've set up a mechanism for enforcement, and the mechanisms for security deposits, requiring the landlord to give it out in 21 days, to do all this or pay double. I have told a number of people, well, you forgot, you sent your notice out on the 25th day, pay the double because you're liable.
That's a different unfair trade practice. What about violation of this unfair trade practice that prohibits saying, hey, you're going to have to pay the landlord's tenant, landlord's legal fees? How can that be enforced? It seems like your position is inconsistent with the underlying rationale of 134, which declares this an unfair trade practice.
We set up a mechanism that if there is a loss, we are going to penalize people for putting these things in. The department did not set up a mechanism to enforce just having it in the lease.
Let's say you're representing a lot of landlords, and the department says, okay, little tenant, you're not going to be your own private attorney general. We're going to be the attorney general, and we're going to bring an action against you, ABC landlords, for your 1,000 leases out there that have this provision.
Yes.
That's a viable cause of action, a viable penalty. In fact, they can ask for forfeitures, if I recall.
Right. And that's what would be the enforcement mechanism in the case that you're giving, that if there was a wholesale violation and the tenants in this case cite a case from Milwaukee where the a landlord was giving uninhabitable places in Milwaukee, giving all landlords a bad name, quite frankly.
But there's no individual ability, then, to bring enforcement under your argument, huh?
Well, there isn't unless there is a money loss because of the clause. So that was the policy set.
So you think, I guess that's what this argument. So in 1978, the Department of Agriculture passed or had an administrative rule which says you cannot do this, this, and this, and this. Your position is I could simply take everything that they don't want, put it in a lease, say that to the tenant, you have to do this, 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 and this. You're saying as long as you don't enforce that, then there's no harm, no foul, and that as long as I didn't enforce these unenforceable or these things put in by the department, then there is no recovery by the tenant.
By the tenant, but that does not forbid the department from going in and asking for fines and enforcing the unfair trade practice.
Of course, that belies the argument that the opposing counsel made about, you know, having someone act, being individual tenant being able to act, that they won't. They're not going to act because there may be thousands of these. So the individual that is put off or doesn't know can't act either or can't recover anything. There's no incentive.
In your example, I agree, but the example is if it's mixed with something else. In this case, the landlord had this clause in there, and it did not cause harm, so therefore it was not part of this lawsuit, except where it came up as a defense for the tenant's action in terminating the lease, and it was used by that way to get out of the lease.
So I assume that instead of the no harm, no foul, you're proposing no harm, but there is a foul, but nothing should happen to you for the foul.
In this case, there should be nothing happening because the tenant, in this case, made the first wrong by terminating the lease early. If the landlord had sued and tried to get reasonable attorney's fees, I would say, so be it, they should have all the penalties. But it didn't. If the landlord was renting an uninhabitable place, the key to this whole contract is when you enter into a lease, you are entering into a lease to rent a place, and you rent the place and you assume it's going to be inhabitable. If you rent an uninhabitable place, the lease should be void. That's the essential part of the lease. And the essential part on the tenant is to keep the place in good condition and pay the rent. The tenant in this case did not follow that and left early so he could move to his new house in Ohio.
So your position here is really that the attorney general should prosecute your client criminally, not have the tenant prosecuted in effect by putting in this defense. Is that what you really want?
Well, the attorney general would have to prove that he did an intentional act, and I don't think that would be provable, but in theory, I guess I have to concede that the answer is yes.
Well, in theory, then maybe the issue here is that this whole point is to get away from the attorney general having to prove this, because he would have too many cases, and the proof would be so hard, so you're going to rely on the tenant as the attorney general. But you don't think that's theory?
No, it's not the theory. It's not the current law in this state. If you want to change the law to say that any illegal provision and any contract voids the whole contract. Overrule the restatement, overrule all the other cases.
Counsel, is it your position that there is in our law, both common law and in our statutes, no distinction to be made between consumer leases or consumer transactions as contracts and the normal restatement of contracts? Is that your position?
Yes, it is. We have some cases where we have given additional protections to consumers.
Let's take a look at 411. 411 is the broad statute that deals with leases. And 411 then speaks about this chapter applies to any transactions regarding the form that creates a lease. And then it describes consumer leases and discusses under the lease, which is used for personal, family, or household purposes, and gives a dollar limitation. And then goes on to describe how consumer, in terms of unconscionability, how consumer leases are to be treated differently. And it gives consumer leases additional protection. Now, this is under the UCC.
Right. Well, 411 is not UCC, but go ahead.
411 isn't UCC?
No, 411 is the Consumer Act, and that applies to leases of personal property.
My 411 says Uniform Commercial Code leases.
Well, I thought 411 was part of the Consumer Act.
It's part of the Uniform Commercial Code. I think it's like Article 2A of the Uniform Commercial Code.
Well, then I stand corrected, Your Honor, because I haven't looked at 411. But I do concede that the legislature, in a number of instances, have made special provisions for consumers throughout the code. The Uniform, the Consumer Act, the Agriculture 134, 125 for mobile homes, home improvement across the board. But those things are made in conjunction with the general common law. If we're going to change the law, then we should be giving notice, put it part of the legislature, let all the landlords, all the tenants, all the banks, all the other consumers argue and put in this law and say this is what the law is going to be. In this case, if you put this framework on the existing law says if it's a non-essential clause, then it should be severed. And that's what I'm asking the court to rule today. I'm out of time, but thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Spear.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think as a number of you have noted, there is a difference between the contracts involved here, that between consumers and business entities, in this case landlord and tenant, and the general contracts that are covered by the restatement. In Simmonstead, which is the case that the counsel for the landlord here has brought up a number of times, I'm sure all of you are aware that in that case what was at issue was the rights of various members of a board of directors of a bank as between each other. And in that case, the provision that was at issue was severed. That question was not something that was covered by statute. It wasn't a consumer code. There was no penal enforcement provided for. In this case, all of those factors come into play. And we're not asking for any change in the law, and this court will not need to make any change in the law. What this court will need to do is simply overturn the Court of Appeals error when the Court of Appeals Court of Appeals changed the law. Law has been clearly out there for anybody to read and know about since Permastone. And the Permastone case obviously cited other cases within it, going back to the early 1926, I think it was, with the Merkel case. It's very important that whatever ruling comes out of this, that it does encourage private attorney general action. The department is here and has said to you that they need the private attorney general action to enforce this code. And if what we really need is not a set of rules that when parties end up in front of a court commissioner or a judge, it gets corrected. What we need is a set of rules that everybody can read, and out there on the street, they do it right in the first place. That was the department's particular point that they made when they adopted the rules in the first place.
Counsel, what about Chapter 411? Have you explored that?
Not specifically as it relates to landlord-tenant, because there's a whole separate particular section related to landlord-tenant. I think Justice Bradley's point was just, I hope I'm getting your point right, was that in that case there obviously has been legislative intent to have there be a difference between consumer contracts and general contracts that have nothing to do with consumers, such as between bank officers. And real briefly, I will note as well that it's been brought up that the first party to do something wrong here was the tenant by choosing to move to Ohio because they got transferred there by their job. However, they weren't the first one to cause foul. It was Mr. Byrell by putting in an illegal clause in his lease. That was the very first thing that was done, and presumably even did it before these particular tenants, because it isn't uniquely written up for them. It's his standard addendum. And we don't know whether he would have tried to get actual attorney's fees, because he never got to that point in the case where he had the right to request them. There's nothing in the way that his pleadings are written that establish he was not going to do that. We just don't know. And are we going to have a rule where the only thing that's done is when he tries to do that, hopefully the tenant or the tenant's lawyer will know that that's illegal. Hopefully the court commissioner will enforce the law and will actually know what it is. We don't want to have a rule like that. We want to have a rule that everybody simply knows. And as the department said when they proposed the rule in the first place, their goal was to see that the rules of fair play would be established by the code and that this would simply be adopted by the rental housing industry statewide. And 20 years later, here we still are with a lease that has this unlawful provision in it. So we need to simply uphold the law as it already is, as it's established in Permastone and Huff and Morris, and have it be the case that this lease is void and that the determination from that affects the rest of the rights of the parties. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Well, that concludes our argument on 98-3329, Bear versus Taggart.